Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. In the 1990s, when I was the director of Minority Rights Group International, I used to travel early in the new year to Finland, to Sweden, and to Norway. And there were three purposes of it. Firstly, to meet with civil society and others and recharge my batteries at the beginning of the year on human rights in a supportive environment. Secondly, it was to talk to officials in the foreign ministries, one or two of them are here today that I recognize again, about the agenda that was coming up at the Commission for Human Rights. And the third was to visit the aid ministries and to help them spend their funds over the coming year. During those conversations, one of the comments that kept on coming up was whether I had visited the Åland Islands. Well, I haven't, but I now have. Thank you very much for this invitation. In the short time available, I will be succinct. I apologize that this will lead to generalizations and simplifications of a highly complex area that Francesco earlier this morning eloquently described. However, there is one common denominator that unites all 39 states that are party to the Framework Convention. Their governments, politicians, and legislature have ratified an instrument of international law that is legally binding domestically. They have done so voluntarily, undertaking to guarantee the rights of persons belonging to national minorities, accepting that the convention should be applied in good faith, and supporting the independence and impartiality of expert members of the advisory committee. Michael Banton, an eminent sociologist and long-standing member of CERD, wrote, "International action against racial discrimination is the struggle to extend the rule of law. It is a highly political struggle because it is about cajoling states to give up some of their sovereignty. They are reluctant to do so unless they can get something in exchange." To paraphrase Petra earlier this morning, she said, "Minorities are perceived as a problem by some states." There has always been some resistance to minority rights. So why was it that so many states ratified the Framework Convention almost two decades ago? How can states be motivated today to promote minority rights and their independent monitoring? What will they get in exchange? Some ratifying states took a principled position to reflect the values of their society. The short time we have, I cannot dwell on that. Let me move on to some other states who are more reluctant, but responded democratically to the representations and pressures exerted by civil society groups, including minorities, including academics. Some states were motivated by a desire to join the Council of Europe, to join the European Union. Some wanted to limit the involvement of neighboring states on kin minorities, while some wanted to gain international prestige in response to peer group pressure. Times have moved on. Nevertheless, there are important lessons that we can still learn from the past, not least the remarkable Helsinki Final Act of 1975. It's appropriate to mention this here. And the confidence-building processes that followed. The human dimension basket that was negotiated provided space for civil society organizations in the Warsaw Pact countries to develop independent human rights monitoring mechanisms. This strategy ensured that when a window of opportunity occurred, much later than 1975, with emerging democracies in 1989 and 1990, it could be seized locally by civil society and internationally by the CSE, as it was, and by others. Timing, local ownership, and collective international support, I suggest, remains crucial, promoting minority rights and preventing conflicts today. The Framework Convention has a unique monitoring mechanism. It is the Council of Europe's Committee of Ministers, which reflects the highly political nature of minority rights in some circumstances. As we all know, it is assisted by an advisory committee of independent and impartial experts that form opinions. At times of financial stringency, there is a temptation to seek synergies and economies that may threaten the perceived independence of the advisory committee and the clear separation of responsibilities. It is crucial that the advisory committee's judicial character and powers must be clearly separated from the executive powers of the Secretary General and also separated from the political and legislative powers of member states. There have been hints at some of the remarks earlier today about that crucial issue. The quality of the opinions must never be compromised. It is important to monitor complex topics, including social and economic issues, Roma issues, and issues such as gender differentiation. The skillful work of the Secretariat and the direct dialogue developed by the presidents of the advisory committee with a committee of ministers over many years has led to the opinions being formed independently. These opinions are closely mirrored by the resolutions of the committee of ministers. Consequently, the potential weakness of the monitoring mechanism has in fact become a strength. Nevertheless, this subtle mechanism is always vulnerable to the politics of individual states, whether it's about kin states or whether it's the states themselves who are subject to criticisms, and how much support is given to the chairman of the rapporteur group on human rights. He needs the clear support, continuous vigilance, and concerted action from states, not least sympathetic states like Finland and Sweden. The Committee of Ministers agreed that the monitoring mechanism should be transparent as possible. That implies not only good information and targeted training, but monitoring visits that are participatory, that explore the real situation and conditions of minorities, and are then accompanied by the speedy production and dissemination of opinions. It requires the timely adoption of resolutions, good quality translations of opinions into local languages, and the use of well-known and easily accessible websites. Dialogue is then needed with all communities and with governments. Indeed, this can be jeopardized by the lack of resources and lead to monitoring fatigue, not just of governments, but of minorities, of civil society, who need the energy and momentum to keep things going. It is crucial to anticipate that in some states, the leadership will be highly resistant to minority rights. And indeed, there have been some extreme occasions that past presidents will tell you about. We don't have time to go into those, but there certainly have been some. In such circumstances, the Committee of Ministers, and it is the Committee of Ministers, must take an uncomfortable stand to protect human rights defenders in an appropriate and dynamic way. And indeed, if I may say so, it was very good to hear from Nina Nordström this morning that Finland is promoting the issue of human rights defenders in a new policy document. In conclusion, Mr. Chairman, I suggest that where states clearly do not implement the Framework Convention in good faith, the Secretary General should work closely with other key actors, including the OSCE High Commissioner, and watch carefully for windows of opportunity for change. Supportive states should also play a constructive role in exerting peer group pressure to help guarantee stability and long-term democratic security throughout Europe. It is crucial to build a local ownership of the Framework Convention, especially among civil society and amongst helpful officials, who in the long term can have the greatest impact in promoting minority rights. I think here today we have much to learn from the situation in the Åland Islands, and this is why it's a great pleasure to have been here today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fields. Also, thank you for...